All right, so Dave and I are thrown into this session to entertain everybody with a crazy idea sort of plan here. So here's another one of those things. And Dave's is crazy and entertaining and good, and mine is crazy and entertaining and sort of more negative. So there's been a bunch of us working on elements of the solid dynamos for quite a while, and a lot of things that we've come up to is that every time we try and make things work like people think it works, then it turns out not to work like that. It turns out to be a lot more difficult. So this is another one in the negative sense of that sort of idea. So this is constraints on the operation of the solar omega effect from some models of shear generated magnetic buoyancy instabilities. Most of this work was done by Jeff Vassell, who was a graduate student of mine, has now graduated and is looking for a job. Advertise him. Let me know if you got a job. I might need one after this as well. So. So anyway, you've already heard it from various people, this thing called the tachocline exists, but one of the reasons we really like the tachocline is for its role in the what we conceptualize as the simple way that the large-scale solar dynamo cycle works, which produces the active regions that we observe as sunspots and all that sort of stuff. So the major concepts on that is it's basically you need some sort of dynamo loop, and there's two parts to this loop. One is creating the toroidal field from the poloidal field, and that is commonly termed an omega-like mechanism because of the mean field letters that were used, Greek letters that were used in the conceptualization of this stuff. Another is an alpha-like mechanism which regenerates the poloidal field from the toroidal mechanism, from the toroidal field. So I'm not going to talk about this at all. What I'm going to talk about is this omega mechanism, which requires differential rotation to stretch out existing poloidal field into toroidal. So the most common way everyone conceptualizes this is this. So we have a rotating sun which has differential rotation, a fast equator and a slow pole. It takes a poloidal sort of field and it stretches it into strong regions, and those regions go magnetic buoyantly unstable and things emerge. Okay, I'm sure you've all come across this concept before, and this is the common way of thinking about it. So this thing, the omega effect, it's basically just an interaction between shear gradients in the velocity field, differential rotation, so in the azimuthal velocity, that's differential rotation, and the poloidal magnetic field to produce strong toroidal field. That's the omega effect, and that's what we're talking about. Now, normally, like that picture I just showed, shows this one possibility where basically you take the latitudinal shear of the differential rotation and act on the latitudinal component of the poloidal field, and you stretch it out into toroidal field that way. Okay, but there's actually the two possibilities, because there's also, if you look at those pictures of the tachocline, a strong radial gradient. And so we can take that radial gradient of the azimuthal velocity and act on a radial field and also create toroidal magnetic fields. So there's another way of doing this. So in this case, you know, going up and down the page here is latitude. In this case, going up and down the page here is depth. So I can take the radial gradient after you act on the radial field and still produce a strong thing. So there's good reasons for sort of looking at that second way of doing things. Here's your picture of the tachocline and the differential rotation as you always see it. If you actually just take the gradients of this thing, and it's the gradients of this thing which are really going to drive this omega mechanism. So if you actually sort of differentiate this picture, you get these two pictures. So the latitudinal gradient looks like this. And the radial gradient of that picture sort of looks like this. And as you can see, there are much stronger radial gradients than latitudinal gradients. And what we really want for that magnetic buoyancy instability is radial gradients. So I need radial gradients to be able to induce magnetic buoyancy. So as you look at the latitudinal one, not much radial gradients except right down the bottom, and they're the wrong way. Whereas in the radial gradients here, I have the right sort of gradients that I need for magnetic buoyancy. So there's good reasons for looking this other way. So the radial shear is stronger, and it gives us the sort of gradients we need for magnetic buoyancy. Plus, you know, if there's any component of the poloidal field which is radial, this is going to be a mechanism which exists. So we might as well examine it and see what it does. Even if you think the other one is doing all the work, you might as well see what this one does. It has another advantage in the sense that if I use the latitudinal gradient, then the scale of the magnetic field that I produce through magnetic buoyancy is the scale of that latitudinal scale of that shear. Whereas if I use the radial gradient, then all I'm doing is producing sheets of magnetic field, and then the scale has to be selected by some other mechanism. Okay? And that other mechanism is the instability mechanism of buoyancy, and it can select whatever scale it wants. Now, that may be related to the shear, as Pat would point out, if he were here. And And so this may still be related to the Shia, but it's different. They're just going to go steps, and who knows what else may come out. So that might be a good thing as we get another method of horizontal scale selection. So this is the case I'm considering. Is this, you know, if I look with depth, so the tachic line is there. So we have some sort of constant sort of azimuthal velocity in the convection zone, or some constant azimuthal velocity in the radiative interior. They're joined by the tachic line, which is strong shear in radius. That's what I'm looking at. So I'm looking at it acting on the radial component of the poloidal field, which in the local approximation I'm going to call the vertical component. And then the idea is that this just grabs this, stretches it out, forms this layer, and this is a strong horizontal infinite magnetic layer. And we know from earlier magnetic buoyancy instability theories that these can go unstable in various forms. So you think, well, let's have a look and see if this works. So let's have a look, see if it works. The answer is yes. Oops, no, answer is didn't work. Oh, come on, why wouldn't that do that? Well, what's happening here? Why won't it click on my movie? Oh, there we go. Jeez, confusing. So here, looking at a box, where what we've done is this is depth. The shear turns on at a layer here. There was vertical magnetic field in this thing. Technical difficulties today. Oh, there we go. And so you could see the first thing that happened was that a layer of green, which is magnetic field in this case, this is a volume rendering of the magnetic intensity. So a layer of green formed in that direction. Then it went unstable in this direction, which is the across the stream, the spanwise direction of the flow, to sort of things which look very much like 2D magnetic buoyancy instability. So there's a high wave number in this direction, and it was independent of X to start with in that direction. Then secondary instability set in, and all kinds of stuff happens. And a lot of things that happen that you want to happen. So for example, large scale sort of undulating regions of magnetic field rise. And this looks like the sort of stuff that you want, arching magnetic structures, arching magnetic tubes coming up out of this thing. So you think, okay, so I took this shearing mechanism and added a weak magnetic field, and I produced this strong toroidal magnetic field, which seems to have a lot of the properties that we're looking for magnetic buoyancy instabilities, okay? So you think, aha, jolly good, it worked. So I'm very happy. Well, oof, that only worked after a large amount of effort. So there's a lot hidden behind this picture. First of all, that's probably my mother calling. There's some little numbers here. Yeah, my mother says that what I said was wrong. So this calculation, as you can see, is pretty complicated. This is a 768 cube calculation. Took about 200,000 CPU hours to calculate this thing. So you're like, yikes. You'd think this was a nice, simple little mechanism you could do in 64 cubed or something like that. But no, you have to go to these crazy numbers to be able to do things. Why is that? Well, there is just proof that it works. The trouble is that the forcing you have to apply to make this thing work, to make the shear flow generate this magnetic buoyancy, turns out to be huge. So this movie, if I can get this one to work, is a movie of what would happen if I... Let's leave that over there in case that's something to do with it. So this is what this hydrodynamic flow would look like if I didn't have the magnetic field in there. So you saw the magnetic field; it seemed to do sensible things. But this is the hydrodynamic flow, okay? So what's the point about this? So the point about this is that the forcing produces a shear flow which is massively Kelvin-Helmholtz unstable, okay? This is not the flow that we had to force with the magnetic field. It's not a hydrodynamic stable flow. It's massively Kelvin-Helmholtz unstable. So if we don't have the magnetic field in, I mean, it creates this mess. The actual forcing required is like a Mach 15 forcing. I mean, it would have a sort of flow of that sort of thing. Of course, it doesn't get there because it goes unstable to Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities. And also in the magnetic case, it doesn't get there, of course, because it has magnetic instabilities. But, you know, the forcing you first thought of was this massively Kelvin-Helmholtz unstable flow. So, and this is the only way we could get this thing to go magnetic buoyancy unstable. You know, if you use smaller forcings, no chance. Okay, forget it. You have to go to this massive calculation to do it. So the big question that emerges from this is, why do we need such a large forcing to make this work? Why doesn't it work with sort of easier forcings? And actually, what I want to do is completely recast this question in something more relevant to this session. And the relevance is, how is the Tacit line maintained? I want to ask that question. So that what I'm really asking is, the standard conception of the Tacit line is that something external is forcing a shear, and then we throw the magnetic field in and it does everything we want to do, right? But the sort of the usual conception is that the way the Tacit line is maintained is completely independent of what's going on in the Tacit line, right? Something external forces it, and the Tacit line is happy forevermore. So the question I'm asking is this a good assumption? Is it independent of the Tacit line dynamics, or must the maintaining process take into account the internal dynamics of the Tacit line? Okay. So in other words, must the Tacit line be strongly maintained even against things which are going on in the Tacit line, as well as all the other things it must be maintained against and externally? So to address this, we thought we'd take two simple analytical models to try and answer this, to try and address this question. And what we do is basically assume that it's not strongly maintained and see what happens, and see if we get a contradiction. So we take two models. One is when it's completely unmaintained, and one is when it's weakly maintained. And if neither of these work, then you think, oh, well, if there's some contradiction, you think, oh, maybe it has to be strongly maintained, and that's the conclusion. Okay, so I've already given away the punchline, but okay. But so the first thing we need to work out is under what conditions magnetic buoyancy stabilities, in this case, will manifest themselves. So there's a standard stability condition due to Newcomb and a lot of work in the past, which basically you can say that the magnetic buoyancy is going to act if I have some gradients of the magnetic field, in this case the magnetic pressure, the way I've recast this, is greater than the buoyancy frequency. Okay, so it's a relationship between magnetic gradients and density gradients. Okay, remember this is a stable, compressible atmosphere and all that sort of stuff. And then you can take into account some thermodynamics. But basically there's a relationship of this kind between magnetic pressure and the buoyancy frequency, which you need to satisfy to have magnetic buoyancy instability. Now, none of this is valid in my case because there's shear going on, so there's no real equilibrium and all that sort of stuff. So this is just an indication, and we're going to use this inequality as an indication of the likelihood of magnetic buoyancy. You know, you think at least this has to be satisfied for something to happen. Okay. Then we're going to look at our two models. So the first model is the model where we're not even going to maintain the shear at all. So, okay, in other words, one way of looking at this is you're saying all the dynamics, the complicated dynamics that you're interested in, the magnetic buoyancy part, happens very, very fast before anything can react back on the shear. So in the unmaintained case, that's what we're assuming, that the shear is completely independent of the Tacit line dynamics. And this is, for example, that the back reactions don't come until later, so we're not going to worry about it. So if you do this, you just do a simple linearization of the equations and ignore diffusivities and that sort of stuff. Then you get two equations basically popping out of this thing. One is the induction equation, which just says that the velocity shear takes the initial magnetic field B0, poloidal magnetic field, and creates the toroidal field BX. This is in the Cartesian geometry. So that's the induction equation. The other is that there's a linear back reaction from the tension. So the field you're creating, the toroidal field, the gradient of that, interacting with the poloidal background field, can react back on the velocity field, which is driving the whole thing. Okay, so it's very simple. And as you can see, this is just a d by dt of one variable times a d by dz equal to a d by dz of another variable, a d by dz of that variable. This is a wave set of equations, right? Simple wave. So these are just Alphane wave dynamics. So you can find the solutions of these things pretty simply for a u and for a bx. And basically, they're just a superposition of whatever initial condition you gave it for the velocity. So two waves of this velocity profile going in different directions. Okay. So I can give you a quick example of how this works in this case. So this is just so if I assume that rho zero was constant in this case, so there's no density variation of the background, it's the easiest way of doing it. You can just get a simple solution like this. And as you can see, what actually happened was initially there was a growth of the magnetic field, then it saturated at some value, then it spread, maintaining that maximum value, and that was it. So I'll start it again. So the initial condition I gave it was this Tacit line-like jump, okay? So I had constant with just a strong shear joining these two pieces. And this was the initial magnetic field. Let's try and do it again. And you can see there was a growth of magnetic field here, then it saturated at some value, and then it just spreads. And this is just Alphane wave dynamics, which is going on here, really. And actually, the growth is not really a growth, because really what it is just a superposition. The solution for B is just a superposition of these two waves. And all it is constructive interference of these two waves while they're in the shear region. And then once everything moves out of the shear region, then you don't get any more growth of these things. So really, you have this Alfvén wave dynamics, which you can take very specifically in terms of the maximum magnetic field. But the maximum magnetic field is completely determined by the interference of these two waves whilst they're in the shear region. Another way of saying it is like, how much time do I have to grow magnetic field? And actually, all I have is the Alfvén crossing time of half the layer. So the time it takes the waves to cross half the layer, I can grow my magnetic field, but as soon as things are outside that layer, I'm done. I can't grow it anymore. So there's a maximum magnetic field I can generate by this process. So there's a linear stretching which generates magnetic field up to that maximum value, and then you're done. And that maximum value is related, obviously, to the jump in the shear that you apply to that thing. So now we have some estimate of the maximum value of the magnetic field we can get. So you can say, have a simple estimate of the gradient of that field. So if I want the gradient of the pressure, which is what I want for that buoyancy and stability inequality, I stick it in that inequality, and what I'm going to get is something like this. So you can see I get this is related to by d/dz of the jump of the velocity, initial velocity squared, and that's going to go into that thing which had n squared over here. So I'm going to get something which looks like d/dz over h is greater than n squared over d/dz of the velocity. So the n squared, the buoyancy frequency over a shear frequency, this is a Richardson number. And so this basically says that a Richardson number of my initial flow has to be less than delta z over h. So in other words, the width of the shear in terms of this pressure scale height. Now, in terms of the Tackett line, the width of the Tackett line in terms of the local scale height is small, 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 small. Okay, so this says the Richardson number has to be small. What does the Richardson number being small mean? It means that the flow you first thought of is hydrodynamically unstable, right? The Richardson number has to be large to be stable. So this is a sort of contradiction to what we want. Or it tells me that what I got was right? I had to force the heck out of this thing with a very unstable shear to get magnetic buoyancy. This says that agrees with that condition, right? So one thing you could say is like, okay, maybe this model is wrong. Maybe that no forcing is good. Maybe you have to maintain this thing. So let's do model two, which says, okay, notice that problem was, you know, seeing as everything happened so fast, it was just a growth of magnetic field. So now we'll say, okay, now maybe if we add some forcing to this problem, I can get into a statistically steady situation where everything balances and I have a magnetic field of a certain size again. So maybe there's a growth phase, and maybe it saturates with this forcing. So I add some weak sort of forcing, or add some forcing to this equation. And look at the steady state of these things. So for now I have forcing, I have diffusion. If I have forcing, I need diffusion. So all this thing now has resistivity and diffusion in it. And I have magnetic tension, so this is the momentum equation. And then I have induction equation. If it's steady, it's just this, you know, diffusion and this stretching of the initial colloidal field again. So if I balance them out, I get this. So these are just d/dz of something, d/dz of something. I can integrate these two equations and combine them into one and try and come up with some bounds on how big bx can get in this process. And I'm not going to go through the mathematics of this one, but again, you're going to get something which is the maximum magnitude of the field is going to be related to the jump, the magnitude of the shear that you applied. But in this case, because of these coefficients, because you've got the diffusions in here, you get a factor of the magnetic Prandtl number in here too. And if you put that back into the stability condition again, you get a very similar condition than the one you got before. Richardson number is less than delta z over h, but now you have a factor of the magnetic Prandtl number in here too. And so this actually makes your life worse in the sun, because the magnetic Prandtl number in the sun is very, very small. So before you had Richardson's number less than something small, now you have Richardson number less than two small quantities multiplied by each other. So this makes your life worse. So what are our conclusions? Like I said, what I was going to do is try and have these two models and see where we came with, see if we came up with a contradiction. And we sort of did. Under the assumptions of weak or no maintenance of the shear, in other words, the shear is independent of Tackett line dynamics, then to get magnetic buoyancy and stability, there's two ways you can do it from that Richardson number criterion, right? Either I have very large forcing, in other words, very unstable shear to start with, which is the one that worked, which is the one you saw in the simulations before, Or my alternative from that other one is that I could do high magnetic Prandtl number, which is not what you want in the sun, but it should solve your problem according to that criterion. And we did another simulation at high magnetic Prandtl number for low, much lower forcing, and did manage to get it work with magnetic buoyancy instabilities too. So it seems to confirm numerically the sort of things we had. So what's the ultimate conclusion of this? The ultimate conclusion is that the maintenance of the tachocline needs to know about the interior tachocline dynamics. You can't just say, the sun does this and maintains a tachocline. Now I'll throw in some magnetic field into the tachocline and see what happens. No, the thing that maintains the tachocline actually has to know about what's going on in the tachocline. So that says that if you really want to know about the properties of how the tachocline amplifies magnetic field and how magnetic buoyancy instabilities happen and how these propagate towards the surface, then you have to do a much more self-consistent, complex problem which involves the process which is maintaining the tachocline at the same time. That's the conclusion.
Okay, we've probably got time for one or two quick questions. Sasha seems to get in there first, I think.
Nick, so if I understand, when you're weakly maintain, you find that it's even more difficult, or you need a... So if you are completely maintained, don't you think you will go in the same direction? What you will see as the process that will make the criteria less stringent, or... You see what I mean?
Yeah, we don't know. I think that's something... I mean, the trouble is that... if you make those assumptions, you end up with this problem. But if you don't make those assumptions, then you've got a completely different problem. But it's a much more complicated problem, right? So you need to have Reynolds stresses or something like that. I mean, what is the maintaining process? So the thing is, we just added a forcing in this thing. But that forcing does not have the feedback of the magnetic field on the forcing. So that forcing has to be a function of all the other stuff that you're putting in the problem, which is not in this case. But you know, if you want it to work, I think that's what you have to do.
Okay, Pat's got a question.
Yeah, Nick, to return the favor, just to let you know I'm here. Could you would you care to speculate one step further? In some sense, could you identify some, shall we say, critical properties or features of the tachocline that would be required to maintain a magnetic buoyancy-driven dynamo? Which is a popular concept among others with you these days.
Some critical properties. Well, I mean, the sun has all the properties that work, right?
Yeah, we know that, but it's in some sense you're back into this question of, you know, the tail and the dog wag each other, right, rather than the dog wagging the tail, right? This is a classic example of a boundary layer kind of controlling, exerting a critical control on what superficially appears as a much larger and more dominant region. So in the question would be, in some sense, what kind of necessary, can we deduce from these kinds of considerations some important aspects of the boundary layer?
No, I think it's very, very difficult because, as you say, the shear that we see in the tachocline is the end result of a nonlinear problem. And what we tend to do is to start these problems by saying, we have this shear, let's put that shear into a nonlinear thing and see what happens. And of course, the shear you get at the end of the nonlinear problem is not the same as the one you put in. So yeah, the inverse problem of saying, I know I want to get at the end of the nonlinear problem, what do I have to put in at the start to give you that? I mean, that's a difficult problem. I'm not sure I have a good answer for you up front about that. But I mean, the conclusion of this is that the what you have to put in is a lot stronger, a lot more dependent on the interior dynamics than you thought. That's my only conclusion I can give you, I think.
Okay, thank you very much. I think time is moving on and we need to move on to coffee now. So reassemble at 10 past 11.